everyone. Thanks for tuning into this week's message. My name is Gregory, and I'm part of the team here at Friends Church. Everything we do around here depends 100% on the generous donations of our local and online communities. That's people just like you who believe that life really is about leaving a positive mark on our world. So if you love what Friends Church is up to, I'd like to encourage you to contribute by going to friendschurch.ca. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
I can hear the crowd from home. I can hear you all screaming and applauding because you guys are awesome and they are singing their hearts out. It's really cool. Good morning, I'm Trevor. I'm part of the charitable giving team. But moreover, maybe I'm part of the team that's saying, hopefully we get to have you back soon. They were talking about it in Heavy. We all want to be together. We do. We're actually, as a church, they're meeting on Thursday actually to discuss, under current sort of restrictions and lifting restrictions, how do we come back together? Because although this is awesome, and it is, because maybe if you're camping right now, you're actually getting to go to church, which is kind of nice, and then maybe you'll go for a hike afterwards. It is neat to be together, and it's neat to have the band and the energy and you as well. So we're looking forward to having you back. In the interim, I want to say thank you. You've been a really awesome part of really keeping us going financially and not having that become a growing concern among so many other things that are going on in our lives right now. And that's because of an awesome community. And we are part of a community. Even though right now it's a little bit more virtual than we might desire, we're still a community and we're missing you and we want you back as well. Take some time to maybe consider this week where else maybe you're able to give to Friends Church or to your neighbors around you. Neighbor Day is coming up next week, and that'd be awesome. And keep looking at the site, looking at your app, because we'll update you about when we're getting back together. We can't wait to see you. Have a great Sunday.
So, before I get to the message, we're going to do a few things here. But before I get to the message, I wanted to just take a moment and just speak a little bit about the questions that we're wrestling with right now as a society. I think like you, these questions are incredibly important. And I'm extremely happy that we are, as a nation, wrestling through what does it mean to be racist? I was reading or listening to a YouTube interview with a guy named Ibram Kendi, just like a heavyweight. He is starting the Boston University anti-racist research department. This guy's written books on it and everything, but there's someone interviewing him, and someone from the crowd asked a question and said, what do you do when someone says that's racist? He says, the first thing I do before I talk about anything is I ask the question, what do you mean by racist? What do we mean by racism? Man, that one just punched me in the face. I love words. You guys know I love words. And suddenly I went, wait a second, that word is a really broad word. If I can geek out for a second, the technical way of saying it is there's a broad semantic range. It means that the word isn't just stuck to one definition, there's a breadth of definitions. And today, I want us to just go through quickly and ask ourselves, what could it mean to say some action is racist? What could that mean? In Friends Church style, I don't have any answers. It's not my role here. My role is to ask questions, to get you to ask questions. And so let me start with this. In grade 6, back in southern Manitoba where I grew up in a Mennonite family. I know it sounds like Mennonite's a religion. In our sense, it was a culture. Own foods, own kind of language, own histories. And the way Mennonites did is they moved all over the place from kind of Europe, and then at some point they landed in southern Manitoba. And the way you got there is really important. So my family came through Russia and Germany and Holland. And just so you know, in the kind of the cool pecking order of Mennonites, Russia, not so good. Germany, really not good. Holland, pretty spot on. So I always said I was the Dutch Mennonite. Kind of basically trying to say, I'm the cool Mennonite. But I went to school with a guy named Six Finger Pete because he was in grade 6 and he only had 6 full fingers left. It was a long story, horrible story. Anyways, Six Finger Pete was a Mennonite, but he was a different kind of Mennonite. His family came through Mexico. And for some reason, in the thinking of Mennonite culture, Mexican Mennonites is different. Now, I'm not proud of how this went down, but Six Finger Jake, I think, came from a pretty rough family. Obviously, there was no supervision because he's already lost four fingers. And I don't think anyone took care of him. And he smelled like a grade six kid who hasn't had a bath in a long time and who hasn't had clean clothes in even longer. So we said he stank. But here's the thing we did in grade six in southern Manitoba. We made a jump from Six Finger Pete stinks to all Mexican Mennonites stink. It's fascinating how our brains can go from a single moment, a single individual, to a group, and back again. The Ontario Human Rights Commission says this: people may experience racial discrimination because of stereotyping. That's the term for this. Stereotyping typically involves attributing the same characteristics to all members of a group, regardless of individual differences. It's often based on misconceptions, incomplete information, and or false generalizations. In most cases, stereotypes assume negative characteristics about a group. Even those who are well-meaning and not overtly biased can nevertheless stereotype. Let me ask you, when we say racism, does stereotyping fit that in your mind? The dictionary says this about racism: racism is defined as prejudice, discrimination, and antagonism directed against someone of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior. I think I live a fairly sheltered life. I hear the odd racist joke amongst my friends. We call it out, swear at each other for a while, but it doesn't seem big. But as I called around this week just to say, what's been your experience with racism? Overt racism. The story started to come back. People saying, yeah, they have an accent, I don't talk to them. Yeah, that group over there, do you have someone white that I can talk to instead of them? I talked to somebody who works for the government, and literally people sitting down and saying, I won't talk to that person because I think they didn't come from Canada like anyone comes from Canada. I think they came from China, wherever, and I don't want to talk to them. Sad to say, it seems that by that definition, if we hold to the dictionary definition, racism is still alive and well, even in its overt forms. And if we could just stop it there, that'd be kind of nice, right? I could just say, hey, let's wrestle with this. Stereotyping, racism. But I think it goes deeper than that. In fact, I think our understanding of racism has evolved, and I think it needs to evolve. That's why the word has a wider semantic range, because the original word, we can say, hey, look, I didn't do the definition of racism, therefore I'm golden. But thinkers have come along and said, wait a second, that word's not quite fine enough. I remember the first time a friend of mine, his name's Justin, said, yeah, me and my buddy Brown Justin were going, and I was like, whoa, what did you just say? It's like, me and Brown Justin. You can't say that. You see, growing up, I was taught that if you see anyone's skin color, if you reference skin color at all, in any way, shape, or form, that's racist. And so I will do mental gymnastics all day long to figure out how to call two Justins without referencing the obvious skin color difference of the one. And yet a friend of mine, actually a member of our community, his name is Cairo, bunch of years ago, I think he said about 10 years ago, he was flying for work. And he flew three times internationally in 1 month. Thousands of people in the lineup. He's there, he's got his bags, blah, blah, blah. And three times out of thousands of people, he was randomly selected for additional screening. What are the odds of that? The only one of thousands of people, and he's the brown guy. His words, not mine. You see, if I don't see skin color like I was taught to, I tell Cairo, you should go buy a lottery ticket because you have some crazy luck. If I see skin color, I ask myself, what are the odds of a brown guy in a sea of white people gets chosen for additional screening three times out of thousands of people? What are the odds of that? One of the writers I was reading this week said this: if you want to deconstruct a system of power and privilege based on skin color, important discussions about the deep-seated racial bias that each of us holds must be addressed. Saying you don't see color disregards the privilege and power of the dominant racial group of society. Therefore, diminishing feelings of bias, prejudice, and racism experienced by people of color. So let me ask, is not seeing color the direction to go? Or is it seeing color? And asking ourselves, when we look through the lens of color, what are we seeing? Recently, we've heard a lot about institutional racism. And it's fascinating to think about that. If I'm not acting racist, I'm good, right? But what if my bank doesn't offer loans to people of color because of their skin color, and I continue to use that bank? What is that? Again, I started with Ibram Kendi. He says this: there's no such thing as being not racist. This is actually the quote that got me here talking about this today. He said, there's no such thing as being not racist. Even inaction, simply being not racist in the face of racism, is, in fact, a form of racism. So let me ask, do we define racism as an action that only I do? Or is it something systemic, something institutional, something bigger than just me? That one's been kicking me in the gut the last couple weeks. A couple years ago, I started studying this really heavily through the Aboriginal conversation in Canada, looking at the Indian Act and what our government's done. And we'll talk about that another time. But someone in our community who identifies as Métis said, Vince, actually there's a new definition of racism I don't think you're aware of. It says this: racism occurs when an expression of racial prejudice emerges from a more powerful, privileged location in the hierarchy and is directed at an individual group in a less powerful, privileged location. Now let me just make that make sense. Essentially it says this: if you have power, financial power, systemic power, institutional power, societal power, it's almost like your voice is a little bit louder than people who don't have power. And so when you're in that place and you say something negative about somebody because of their race, that's considered racism. That one's easy. But, and here's the big shift: if you're in a position where you have less power than the dominant group and you say something that encompasses something about the whole group in a negative way, what we would call racism by the first definition, because you lack power, in this definition, that's not considered racist. Man, when I first read that, I was like, well, I'm sticking to the old definition. But as I read it more and wrestled with it more, I think it's like this. There's people in our community, in our world, who have voices that, let's just say their volume is louder. They have a platform. They have societal power. They have historic power, whatever it is, they have something that allows their voice to be heard a little more than others. And then we have another group whose voices are quite quiet. What would happen if we just turned down the volume of this group and turned up the volume of this group so that it sounded equal in volume? Everyone could be heard. I think that's what this definition is challenging us to do, saying, wait a second, how do we get this conversation around race so that it's equally volumed across everybody? And so they allow a certain group of people to use a bit stiffer language. Another group, they turn that language down a little bit. To be honest, I'm still wrestling with this one. On the one hand, I think it's beautiful. On the other hand, I'm going, wait, but racism, as I defined earlier, is just any group thinking another group's lesser than, right? But this nuances something different, doesn't it? And so let me ask, does power need to be part of your definition of racism? Let me finish with just two more thoughts. Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter probably for many of us started off with, but wait, all lives matter, right? And it's true. But I've never heard somebody say, hashtag only Black Lives Matter. What I think, what I'm hearing, and what troubles me so deeply is that a group in our society, a subgroup in our society, whoever you are, somehow feels less valuable than the rest. And I don't even care about the objective part of it. I just care about the subjective part. There's a group of people who say, for some reason, I don't feel as valuable as everybody else. So the question I want us all to wrestle with today is this. Do we want a society that has a group of people inside that society that feels less than? That feels like their lives are worth less than everyone else's life? To feel like somehow they're not equal to everybody else? Do we want to live in a society like that? I'm going to end with a final quote. It's on this idea of anti-racism. It's by this great thinker. Her name is Ijeoma Oluo. She says this, the beauty of anti-racism is that you don't have to pretend to be free of racism to be an anti-racist. Anti-racism is the commitment to fight racism wherever you find it, including in yourself. And that's the only way forward. You see, anti-racism is this idea that says, if there's racism at all, we all fight against it, no matter where it is. We fight racism. We fight a group of people feeling less than, less valuable. We fight that. And I don't know if anti-racism fits into your worldview of racism. I don't know where you sit today. But man, these questions have been rolling around in my brain for weeks and years now. It is more important because as Friend Church, we exist to make the world a better place. We exist to physically make the world better by interacting with people, by sharing, by speaking, by changing how we behave so that this world physically gets better. And so my question for you is this, how has that played out in your discussion of race? Even in your dialogue with people around race, man, I have seen people ripping other people to shreds because they said something wrong, they didn't agree with the definition of racism, something, and it just became brutal. And I ask myself, is that making the world better? I don't know. Friend Church, we're all on a unique journey, so you're going to have to figure out what your role here is, if there is a role for you here. All I ask is this. I hope you think deeply about this. I hope you talk to people you love about this. I hope you start conversations. I hope you read about this and figure out where do you sit in this issue and what, if anything, you can do. If you have any questions or comments, I'd love to hear it. Vince at Friend Church. Okay. Let's shift some gears. Let's talk about joy. Okay. So, number of years ago, single gentleman, newly divorced, I'm out and about, and I happen to meet a beautiful florist who I'm buying flowers from, and very quickly I'm realizing I'm thinking about her more than possibly just I think about most florists. Well, one thing leads to another, and pretty soon we're dating, and pretty soon we've fallen in love, and we've moved in together, and then we've realized we have a problem. Here's this beautiful woman who lives, breathes, eats beauty. So flowers for her is just like the lyrics of her soul. And if things aren't beautiful for her, it's just there's nothing there. And so she's like a beauty addict. And there's me on the other side, who if there's not threat of death at all times, I'm kind of bored. I don't want to do it. People have called me an adrenaline junkie. I think they're wrong. I might like a little adrenaline now and again. So how does a beauty addict and an adrenaline addict figure out how to holiday together? This is not easy, folks. This is a bit complex. And so we sat down together and we started to wrestle through, okay, skydiving's not going to go. Basket weaving, I'm not going to do that. So what do two people do? And so here's what we finally came to, scuba diving. You see, when you're 50 feet underwater, there's fear of death, right? So I'm feeling good. And underwater, there's these incredible coral reefs that have plants and fish that, like the plants, it's like they defy gravity. They're these skinny things that are floating up and insane colored fish and coral that look like the inside of someone's brains. And like these reefs just blow your mind. And so we have beauty. It's beautiful, right? Beauty and fear of death at the same time. So we thought we had the perfect sport to do together. The perfect holiday adventure, scuba diving. And it was going good until we were 50 feet underwater at one point, and Ellie's brain suddenly realized that she's 50 feet underwater. Humans shouldn't be 50 feet underwater. That's what happens when you drowned. And suddenly her brain went from, ooh, look at the beautiful coral, to, sweet mother, I'm going to die. I need to get out of this now. What started off as this beautiful, like, look at the flowers, look at the coral, look at everything, how beautiful it is, to literal sheer panic. The most beautiful turtle could have swam right in front of her in that moment, and she would not have seen a bloody thing. Her brain was saying, I'm going to die. We need to fix this now. And so she was all just like trying to get to the surface of the water, right, before she dies. Fair point. We're 50 feet underwater. Humans aren't meant to be under there. Science that helped us get there, not reliable. And suddenly we realized something. Beauty and happiness and joy, those things don't go well with threat of death. Think about it. You're hiking along one day, beautiful trees, beautiful path. You walk around the corner. You know, you're having just the most lovely time. Everything's, you're open-hearted. You're seeing joy everywhere. You walk around the corner. There's a grizzly bear, and the baby grizzly bears are right behind you. What exactly are you thinking in that moment? Are you thinking about how beautiful the flower is next to the grizzly bear's open mouth that's about to eat you? No. Maybe when you get back to your truck and the doors are locked and the grizzly can't get you anymore, you have this like, I cheated death. I don't even know what to do, but I kind of feel elated somehow. The Dalai Lama and the Desmond Tutu, or Bishop Desmond Tutu, they sat down in this conversation around joy, but it wasn't systematic. It wasn't, okay, let's start here and systematically go through it. It was two men talking about the wisdom of their lives. And so as I read their work, it wasn't like systematically put through, but as I read them, suddenly I realized what they're trying to say is threat is antithetical to joy. And threat's easy to see when we think of it from the realm of you're 50 feet underwater and you're going to drown because the scuba equipment clearly is not going to work. Or coming around the corner and seeing a grizzly bear. That threat is easy. But what happens when your best friend calls you up out of the blue and says, I'm sick of you and you're crap and you're too much and I don't want to talk to you anymore? What happens when your company posts a new org chart and your job's not on the new org chart? What happens when you see your kids do something that you're going, of all the things you should do in this world, that is not one of them? You should not be going with those people, doing those kind of things in that way at that time. All of these are registered in our bodies as threat. Even somebody who you love has an angry expression on their face. Studies say that your body will go into seeing threat. We see threat everywhere. Physical, social, emotional, attachment. We make up threat. Some point in the future, this is going to happen, and so I'm going to freak out now, and my nervous system is going to all dysregulated because I think something's going to happen. It hasn't even happened yet. Where do you feel threat in your life? Where do you see that reaction to, like, whoa, suddenly there's no joy here? Let me be clear. For the sake of this series, we defined happiness and joy very particularly following the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. Happiness is this idea that says, when something happens that I like, I feel happy. I really like French fries. When I get a really good plate of French fries and I stick a French fry in my mouth, boom, happy. If I get a French fry that's kind of like undercooked and limp and I stick that in my mouth, that's a crap fry. I don't care what you think. If they're not crispy, crap. If I stick a soggy fry in my mouth, I am not happy. There's all kinds of ways we can be happy, but it's all based on something happening. A friend calls us and invites us to a party, happy. Boss calls us in, says you're getting a raise, happy. Our kid does something incredible that we're proud of, happy. This whole week, me and my partner have been talking about Schadenfreude, which is a German word that says happiness at somebody else feeling not happy. So when someone speeds by you, and then they get pulled over later on, and you watch them as they're pulled over, and you kind of chuckle, like, Schadenfreude. Folks, you would not believe how much Schadenfreude's out there. It's this idea that when bad things happen to other people, we get some joy to that. But here's the thing with happiness. It's all dependent on externalities. If those fries are undercooked, if my kid will not go on stage, if that person doesn't get pulled over as they cut me off on Deerfoot speeding past me, if any of those things happen or don't happen, I lose happiness. Happiness is always, in this definition, dependent on something outside of us. But joy is different. Joy comes from a profoundly deep place inside of us. They describe it as this deep well of kind of well-being that comes out, that regardless of the suffering we're in, regardless of what's going on around us, regardless even our thoughts of the future, we can find joy. Even when we're not happy. Even when our kids are screaming again and we're trying to get work done and we told them 6 times to stay focused on school but they're not doing their schoolwork and so now we're mad. There still is this moment where you look at your kid and go, you're my kid. I kind of want to kill you right now, but like, you're my kid. There's these moments of joy sprinkled through all of our lives. The Dalai Lama loves to talk about a woman after giving birth, one of the more painful things in this world. And yet, they bring the mother the baby, and the amount of joy coming into that moment is just incredible. Joy is not dependent on anything. It can be raining outside. We can get a flat tire. Bad things can happen. And yet we still can have this well-being inside of us that brings up the sense of joy. Man, being around people who have joy, they are incredible to be around. They're the people that, you know, something bad happens and everyone's like, that's all everything's going. And they're just like, hey, well, tire's flat. Guess I get to sit on the side of the road and enjoy the sunshine today. They find these amazing moments throughout life, regardless of the externality. Happiness dependent. Joy, not so much. But here's the deal. There's things that can undermine our ability to tap into that deep well. And that's why I started with threat. Because it seems that joy is antithetical to threat. Any threat. Social threat, economic threat, financial threat. Our nervous system handles it the same way. A researcher named Steve Porges has done a tremendous amount of research on this. He says, the system that we use right now, our ability to interact as human beings relationally, that's a profoundly new system. Like evolution, that's the very end of evolution. And we're kind of teetering on this like precarious balance of being able to work with other people, have them calm us down, calm them down. But he says, as soon as our nervous system picks up threat, and I'm going to be really specific here, our nervous system picks up threat. This isn't me, this isn't you, this is something inside of us that's designed to pay attention to threat. It's trying to keep you alive. And it'll fire threat wherever it sees it. You're a kid and your mom looks away a little too quick, threat. The markets start to tip down a little bit, threat. Loud noise, threat. Threat's all over the place, and our nervous system is constantly watching for it. Having a conversation with somebody and their face goes flat, threat. Here's the thing. When we go under threat, Porges says, we go into one of two states. Remember, this one's fairly new. The next newest system is fight or flight, mobilization. Right? Loud noise, we jump. Mobilization, get me out of the threat. Something happens, we fight back. Someone says something to us, we yell at them. We say something and the person's like not paying attention to what we're saying. We're like, what are you doing? Pay attention. Your eyes just closed. What the heck? This is our fight or flight system, our mobilization system. And I don't know about you, but my mobilization system goes off at the weirdest times. The other day, I tried to turn my TV on with my remote. Couldn't turn it on. I just about threw the remote out the window. Right? Mobilization. I'm trying to move something. I'm trying to do... Now, the fact that I can't turn my TV on drives me to want to throw my remote out the window says that probably systemically, my life isn't in great balance right now. Fair? So let me ask you, where are you mobilized? Where are you reacting with fight or flight? Because if you can look into those emotions, you can trace it back and to see where your nervous system is seeing threat. You can see the thing that's stealing your joy, right? Because joy is antithetical to threat. And if we can find threat, maybe we can find joy again. The oldest system in our bodies, our nervous system, so earliest one, relational system. Next one down, mobilization, fight or flight. The last one is immobilization. We see it in horror movies, right? The monster's coming down the hallway and the person's just sitting there like shaking and not moving at all. It's immobilization. It's playing dead. You'll see it with kids. Their parents are fighting. They're sitting in their room and they're just quiet. They're not moving at all. It's kind of like, maybe if I don't move, no one will see me and I won't get killed. You see it with bunnies on the road, right? They're sitting there and they're like, no one sees me. And I'm going, dude, you're white on a brown thing. Like, but somehow their nervous system says, if I'm just still enough, maybe I won't get killed. Now put it into our lives. How many of us are immobilized? We aren't willing to say the things we need to say to the people we love to build a better relationship. We just keep our mouths shut. We get stuck in jobs that we don't want that feel threatening and they feel horrible, but we can't move. We're frozen. We can't do anything. The mobilization stage, that's too high up. We're down deeper than that. Someone asks us a question that feels threatening and our nervous system just shuts us right down. Boom. Our brains go blank. I don't know. Where in our lives are we immobilized? You see, Porges says, this is the polyvagal theory. It's based on a vagus nerve that runs through your body. It's not something you can choose. It's not something you can ask. It's not something you can say, hey, look, I'm not going to do the polyvagal thing this time. I'm just going to do it consciously. No, this is happening faster than thought. And I think it's killing our joy. So the question I started to ask immediately, and I'm hoping you're asking, is how do I get out of threat? How do I use what I know about immobilization and mobilization to kind of tunnel my way into my nervous system and go, what am I freaking out about? What is my nervous system freaking out about? Because if I can deal with that, maybe I can find joy again. Porges says there's four ways to do this. The first one you already did. You're a quarter of the way done. You now know about your polyvagal system. You know about mobilization. You know about immobilization. And so now when you feel yourself go blank, you can go, wait a second. When my brain comes back online, I'm going to figure out what was the moment that caused that? What was the threat? If you find yourself wanting to yell at your partner or yell at your kids, what was the threat? If you find yourself trying to get out of a meeting, just like taking off, what was the threat? You can now use this awareness to tunnel your way back into your nervous system to figure out what it thinks is the threat. What's killing your joy? So the first thing you do, be aware. Use it to tunnel back. Second thing is kind of a funny one. So here's Ellie, 50 meters under the water, scuba diving, right? No human should be 50 feet under the water. We can't breathe water. Like, that just doesn't work. One of the ways she could solve that is just never go scuba diving. Kind of removes the threat of her life, right? Easy peasy. If I'm standing on land, I don't ever have to worry about drowning. That seems like a good option. And so whenever you feel threat, as you use your awareness to tunnel back in and find the threat, one of the things you can do is just move. Job that's making me feel scared, move. Get a different job. Find a more stable career. We live in Alberta. When I first got here 20 years ago, I saw a bumper sticker. Please, God, give us another oil boom. We promise not to piss it away this time. I was like, what's that all about? But it speaks to the volatility of oil and gas, right? When you're working, you're making tons of money, but the second things go south, you're gone. And so if your nervous system finds that threatening, chances are you need to get out. Physically remove yourself. If your kid's screaming is driving you nuts, find someone to take care of them. Go for a walk for 20 minutes. Physically remove the threat. Move, if your relationships are causing you threat, rework them, move on them, do something. Physically get away from the threat. That's the running away system, but we can use it with some skill now, right? Wait, I tunneled back up through my fear, through my anger and my desire to run or my immobilization, and I figured out the threat. It was when you said this. You know what, when you talk that way, that doesn't feel comfortable for me, so I'm just going to go for a walk and I'll come back in half an hour when things are calm. That's removing the threat. And then we can find joy again. The next thing you can do is, the metaphor is we have multiple brains. If anyone does meditation, we have the observer and the thing that we observe. There's many different metaphors for this, but it's basically finding some part of yourself that feels safe. And use it to talk to the part of yourself that feels under threat. Ellie did it. We were 4 feet under the water just training. And she's like literally like laying on the bottom of the pool in scuba gear. And so she starts freaking out. And she's like, wait a second. I can just stand up. Like the surface of the water is like right there. And her body started to calm down. Oh yeah, you're right. We don't need to. Our life isn't threatened here. You can use one part of your life to calm another part. If work is really stressful, but your relationship's really solid, you can say, yeah, work's pretty stressful right now, but man, I'm so blessed to have the family I do. You can use that to reset the threat threshold. There's ways that we can use parts of ourselves that feel good. I feel good in my body. I feel fit. But you know what? My relationships aren't doing good. Or this part of my life is good, but this part is feeling threatening. And I can use one to speak to the other and calm it down. I'm only 4 feet underwater. I can just stand up and I'll be fine. The final thing is one of the branches of the vagal nerve runs down into your gut. It's why often when we feel nervous, we feel it in our guts, right? No one's ever said, like, this plane's about to take off and I'm nervous. I feel it in my pinky. You don't say that. You say, like, I feel it in my guts, right? You feel it here. We all hold our stomach. It's because the vagal nerve runs into there, and so it's sending signals down saying, we're not safe. I've talked to people who have been in mobilization for years, and they describe gut problems that their doctor can't figure out. It's because their vagal nerve is sending stuff down saying, there's a threat, we need to do something. But you can actually go backwards up the chain. Whenever I run men's groups, this is primarily what we do. You breathe deep into your belly. Try it right now. Just take a deep breath. If you push it into your belly, what it says to that vagal nerve is, there's no threat. We're okay. If you breathe high into the chest, that's what we do when we're nervous. You can feel it. You start to get jacked up. You want to breathe more. Breathing into your belly, really low into that vagal nerve. It calms the system. If we can remove the threat, we can find joy. The Dalai Lama spends much time talking about that third option, mental fortitude, the ability to talk yourself out of negative things, to talk yourself out of threat, to calm yourself, to find perspective, to do a million different things, but it's to get you out of threat so that you can feel joy. Because threat doesn't seem to have the ability to play with joy. Traditionally, people in churches have done this for years. They use the super being concept they call God that says, God has a plan. This is all has a purpose. Someone's got my back. It's all a way to calm threat, to calm our systems. So let me finish with this. What's freaking your nervous system out right now? Where is it seeing threat? You'll know it because you'll want to fight, you'll want to flee, you want to shut down, you want to just turn off. Where is that threat stealing your joy? What can you do physically to get out of that threat? Can you move? Can you change? Can you say what you need to say? What do you need to do? Yeah, it's probably going to be hard. That's why you haven't done it already. But if you want joy, and if threat and joy don't play together, then somehow we have to remove the threat. How do we physically get ourselves out of things that scare our nervous systems? Or we can use one part of our nervous system to calm down the other part. Where do we have calm parts inside of us that are just like, okay, no, here I feel okay. There, oh yeah, that's threat, but here I feel okay. How can you use this to calm this so you can find joy? Let me ask, are you breathing deep into your belly? I know it seems weird. I know culturally you're not supposed to do that because you're supposed to suck your belly in. The reality is it works. I start almost every morning by breathing into my belly, and I can tell very quickly how I'm doing. It's like, ooh, I haven't taken a day off in a while. Okay. Ooh, I'm feeling a lot of threat someplace because I cannot breathe properly. And I use that to calm myself back down. I wish breath worked. You know, you can neglect this all and then get into threat and just take a couple deep breaths and the threat will go away. It doesn't really work that way, it seems. It's kind of like you have to keep a practice, a low level of calm. But we do this not because we really like polyvagal theory, although I do. We do this because I think we all want that joy, that deep wellspring of well-being from inside of us. That sense that things are okay regardless of the externalities going on around us. Friend Church is about making the world better, and yes, I believe if you think deeply about this and wrestle with this and engage with this in your life, this will lead to joy for you, but I think there's a bigger piece than this. We've all been in a room with someone who has no joy, and it's painful. Like, just, they're dragging everyone down. And here's the question I always ask myself, is that me? Am I the guy who's in the room without the joy that's dragging everyone down? Or am I bringing joy to this moment? Am I bringing laughter when things are a little uncomfortable? Or am I bringing a sense of well-being when people are nervous? Or am I bringing a sense of we care about everyone? That the line, love expands my chest. To me, that's joy. Are we bringing that into the people around us? The people we love, the people we meet on the street, the people on the other side of the world, the people who don't look like us. I don't know about you, but I want more joy. I want more joy for me, and I want more joy to share. I want to be that person that lifts the room up. I want to make the world better in that way. But I don't think it works when threat is running our lives. So let's use this idea to lower the threat, to open up, as Desmond Tutu and Dalai Lama say, open up a pathway to joy. I'd love to hear from you. Send me an email, vince@friendchurch.com. Tell me your thoughts, your stories, whatever. Next week, we're going to get into what it takes to build that wellspring. So today I told you what kills it. We're going to start talking about what builds it. I'll see you guys there. Have a great week, everyone.